gente, welcome to another episode of El ADN Podcast, where every week we sit down with the movers and shakers of our culture for an honest and intimate conversation about their career journey, including all the challenges and failures they've overcome to reach their current success. I'm your host, Victoria Leandra. Natalie Compton is a staff writer reporting on travel for the Washington Post's new travel destination, By the Way. She began her journalism career in 2015 while living in Southeast Asia and has written for national and international outlets including JQ, Vice, LA Times, Wired, Bon Appetit, Food & Wine, Playboy, and many others. We talked about how to pitch your story ideas to editors and how to start traveling, even solo. We know that you're currently a staff writer for the Washington Post, but that wasn't always the case. You weren't always in the journalism side of things. You started in PR. So tell me a little bit more about that world and how you sort of made the transition.
I always wanted to be a journalist. That was the dream 100%, but I did not think of it as something that was actually possible. I really thought of it as a dream. I feel like since I was young, we heard about newspapers dying. English degrees were a quote unquote joke. You needed to do something that was more practical. So when it came time to choose a college, I was not thinking about journalism. I truly thought that's not going to happen. So I went to a school thinking I was going to do law. I had the scholarship for a law program and got there and realized I did not like law at all and graduated early with a very generic communication degree that was not focused on much of anything. It was just, it was more for people who wanted to do communications teaching almost. So very general degree. And when I left, I had been doing internships in different fields and had enjoyed doing public relations. It was a way to work with journalists. You got to write, you got to go places and it felt journalism adjacent. So I did like that, found a job in San Francisco, started as an internship there, unpaid, working at a restaurant along the way to pay my rent. And eventually they hired me, did restaurant and hotel public relations, which was a fantastic way to learn how to be a professional. Coming out of college, it was where I learned to send professional emails and write press releases and be a more put together adult. In hindsight, I do think it was a better way to start my career than having just gone into freelance. But it wasn't until I decided to kind of have an adventure and go move to Bangkok and got a job working at a startup there doing communications as well. I had an accident at our company retreat where I dove into this pool in the night and I split my head open, ended up being in the hospital, 60 stitches. And I thought my life was over. The life that I knew I thought was over. I was ready to move home to the United States. I thought maybe my parents are going to have to take care of me. It was all just like immediate thoughts. I had a neck brace on. I didn't know what was happening. I felt kind of slow from either the trauma or the medicine. And my only regret when I was in the hospital, as I'm like laying there in rural Thailand, just being like, oh my God, I blew it. It wasn't, oh, you didn't get married or you didn't do this or that. It was really just, I didn't try to be a journalist. I didn't even try. I didn't try and fail. I just never tried. And so when I got out and started to recover, I started trying to freelance on the side and I reached out to food delivery blogs and random publications that did not pay any money, but I just started doing this to get some bylines going. And eventually my first big break was emailing just info@vice.com and sending them a story idea. They said no, but I could send more. And I sent 10 more and they picked one. And that kind of felt like a game changer. I was going to get paid. It was going to be on Vice. Like, this is it. 3 months later, I quit my job at the startup, started working at a magazine over there, quit that 3 months later and went full-time freelance for the next like almost 5 years.
Wow. First, I want to talk about the fact that you just packed your bags and moved across the world. Like, how old were you? What was going on through your head? Talk to me a little bit through that process.
I always regretted not living abroad when I was in school, but when I was in college, I was like, I want to finish as fast as possible. It wasn't my favorite environment. And I just thought, if I finish this, I can go and be an adult and do whatever I want. So I regretted not studying abroad because I think it's such a special opportunity to have a network of people. And so I had been in San Francisco working, and a friend of mine was, she was going on a vacation before starting a job in Northern Thailand. And she asked me if I wanted to go to this vacation with her. And I was like, I would love to go. But I just got in trouble with my boss at the place that I was working because I took a 4-day vacation to go to Europe with my friend on, you know, stay in hostels and be very budget friendly. But I'd truly gotten in trouble for it. So they said I hadn't been working there long enough to take any time off. And I was like, oh my God, I will never be able to go on this trip with my friend to Southeast Asia. And I had the dream of living abroad. In the past, I thought, oh, I've studied French. I would love to go to Paris, but don't speak good enough French to get a job there and didn't want to be an au pair or something. So the idea in my head of living abroad was absolutely a dream. It wasn't until this friend was going to Southeast Asia and I couldn't go on vacation that something just snapped and I was like, I'm going to move there. And she was like, what? And I was like, when you buy your plane ticket, I'll buy mine. And she thought I was insane. I thought I was insane. And I bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok. And it was about maybe 4 or 5 months out. So it was pretty far in advance. And that gave me the time to start emailing all these people. I looked at like expat business newsletters and emailed companies I found that I knew would have English speakers and maybe be open to foreigners. And it wasn't until 2 weeks before my flight that I got a job offer that was like, woohoo, wow. It was a close call because I would need a visa to stay. So it was kind of a spur of the moment decision with roots in a dream that I had longer.
Right.
The other thing was that I was in such a privileged position to know that if everything went horribly, I could move back home with my parents. That wasn't ideal, but I was welcome in their home, or I could go live with my sister. I knew I wouldn't end up financially ruined. I was lucky to not have student loan debt. So I had some advantages that I think not everybody has. So I know there are people who would love to do this, but have to be caregivers in their family or have student loans. So I do think that for people who are in really lucky positions to get to do this, you have to not be lured by the common career path and think, oh, if I break away from this, I'll never rise up in my career, or I'm going to miss out on promotions, or I'm going to be behind when I get back. But in reality, taking this risk and doing this kind of crazy thing helped me jump the line significantly in my career. So it worked out, even though it was the fun option.
Exactly. And how old were you at the time?
I was 23 when I moved. Okay. Thought I was very old, and now I'm 31 and I feel much younger and weird. Like it's just funny how sure I was of what I was doing. And now I'm like, wow, that's a crazy person thing. So you have to jump on those before your brain catches up and be like, is this a bad idea? Just do it.
Now, you mentioned that you went freelance after that job. How did you go about going freelance specifically for sort of like a niche part of journalism, similar to music, for example, or food? When you first started, bring me back to those days for the readers, for the people who are listening. Literally, you sat down in a computer and what did you do? Give us some steps there.
One of the things that I had done back in junior high, high school, college was always write for my student newspaper. That was always fun for me. And I felt like it was an opportunity to cosplay my dream job, whether or not I could end up doing it later. So I had some experience in what actually is an article, and maybe that would be helpful. I think if somebody has never done that before, that might seem daunting to be like, where do you even start? But I had an idea of what do I need to do to write a story. But when I moved, I also started a blog. It was not ever a thought that this is going to be this thing that blows up and will be cool and I'll make this a job. It was strictly a way to show my family and friends, what am I doing? Write about my experience, keep track of what was happening. It was almost like a diary. And I could send pitches and link back to some of that writing, even though it was not published anywhere. It was like, this is an example of what I can do, what I can write, what my photography is like. So it was a way of showing work before I had work. And I think even in the very earliest days, I was still sending a couple articles from my college newspaper, which at the time I think was embarrassing, but it's like, whatever, as long as you have something you can show that is your work, I'm sure I would find it very cringy to read that writing now, but people seem to think it was fine. So the biggest part of jumping into freelance was definitely something that was taught in public relations, which was finding people's email addresses and contact information to try to get in touch with these editors and ask, can I write for you? And in PR, that was just finding these people so you could email them pitches and be like, write about my client. And in this case, I was using it for a very different thing, but looking on Twitter, do they have their email address on their Twitter? Do they have their email address on the website? Where can I find it? How can I find ways of getting in touch with these people and figuring out who the right people to talk to were? So once you're figuring out, I want to write for GQ, who's the editor? How do I get in touch? Then it was a lot about pitching and sending emails. A lot of the life is not very glamorous. It's sitting behind a computer and trying to get somebody to say yes to you, sending dozens of pitches, nothing, like absolute silence for about 80% of them, no's for a big chunk of the rest, and then occasionally you'll get a yes. And once you do get those assignments, then following through with going out and chasing the story, whatever it is. I think that getting started in, like you said, it wasn't general news. It was something that I was very passionate about. I think that also was a way of getting into it where I had a lot of zest and excitement to have the hunger to want to do this in a hustly way. It was like fun for me. I was excited to do these pitches and excited to be covering these things. It was a slow roll to start. And then the more pitches you're sending, the more relationships that you're making with editors, more work comes. But I think a lot of people don't realize that many people who are in journalism, especially lifestyle journalism, have other sources of income or have a spouse who is helping them pay the bills. And I didn't learn that for a long time. And I was just like, how are these people making it? I'm making $30,000. What are these people doing? And then you kind of see later, you're like, oh, okay, this makes more sense because some people are having help. And I also encourage people who are getting into it to consider stuff like that. Consider trying to, if you are good at another thing, there's no shame in a side hustle to help you afford your lifestyle while you are getting started in writing, because that it pays slowly, it pays low, and sometimes you have to chase people to get paid. So having other sources of income can be helpful if you can find it.
Usually, journalists start at a media publication and then they go freelance, but you just jump right into the freelance life and sort of made it a business from the get-go while you were young. Did anyone give you guidance there, or you just went and did it by yourself and learned from the punches?
I think it was helpful when I was in public relations that I was talking to a lot of journalists and I kind of heard their stories. Also, in a way, it was discouraging because I remember thinking at the time, oh my gosh, these people have gone to Harvard and Yale or Berkeley Journalism School. And I was like, okay, this solidifies I'm never going to be able to do it. But I also saw other writers who had gotten into the industry in a different way, or people who were both spin instructors and covering food and drink in San Francisco or something. And seeing how the job could be done in different ways, I think, was really helpful. I think early on, it was actually the advice of a person who gave me an opportunity to write for an outlet in Bangkok who was really happy that what I had turned in was very clean. And he had said that it is rare to get people who read over their stuff and make sure there are no errors, that it's finished, that it, you know, it reads well. And that a lot of freelancers are kind of living in this chaos and not really thinking about the editor on the other side who's going to be getting it. And you think that's kind of obvious, but really, it's not the case. I now work with a lot of people who edit freelance work, and they talk about all the time how they're getting incomplete stories turned in, things are getting turned in late. So I found that early on, hearing how important it was to turn in like a great finished product, being really communicative with your people who have assigned you work and be like, I'm going to be late on this. That is so much better than ghosting them or going silent while they wonder, okay, we had this on the schedule and now we have no idea where it went. And I also had great advice. Again, this is from public relations, that was you never know where people are going to end up. So I think we would have people that we were reaching out to say, will you cover these clients? And you might look at somebody from the New York Times and be like, oh, I must treat this person like a king because you are from the New York Times and you're so powerful. And you might not feel the same for a blogger or somebody who is working at a very small regional publication because you're like, oh, it's not the same. But then give them 5 years and they're at the New York Times, or the New York Times person may leave the next year. And if you were rude to that smaller person and snubbed them, first of all, that's just being a bad human being. But second, it's bad for professional reasons. Not only might that person end up in a much higher position, they might end up being somebody you want to apply for a job to later. Or in the world of journalism, you never know who's going to leave to another publication and want to take you with them. So it's really important not to burn bridges and treat everyone with a lot of respect and kindness as you go. It's very impersonal. You don't hear people's voices. I never saw a picture of my second vice editor. I was just like, I don't know who this is. It could be anybody. But just remembering that there's a paper trail. You have a reputation to maintain. Be nice to everybody and be on time and do clean work.
Specialty journalism is a little bit mysterious. Can you demystify travel journalism? How does it work? Now you're a staff writer, but when you were freelancing, you were sending these pitches. Were you paying for these trips yourself? Did they give you some budget? How, on a financial level, as a freelance working in travel journalism, how did it work for you?
I think it's really interesting to talk about that question right now because we are in a shifting time for travel journalism. We see that here we have two travel sections. The one that I work for is kind of focused on online only. City guides written by local people, tips that people can use. Whereas kind of the traditional travel journalism has always been like, I went hiking in Nepal and like beautiful stories, beautiful storytelling. That's not always the case, but that was a lot of what it was. And so nowadays, when I'm talking to people about what should they be pitching or what do travel editors want, it's how can you make somebody else's trip better? How can you make practical information? Everybody's looking for how-to stories. And people are also looking for interesting stories that showcase travel in different ways. The New York Times just had this fantastic story about how people who travel in wheelchairs at air travel, how humiliating it can be, what the risks are to them, how their chairs can get damaged, and that kind of journalism, holding people in power accountable, even in the travel space, seems to be a pretty big part of it now. So that is definitely our focus. But when I was a freelancer, I obviously did not know any of that or where the industry was going, what was happening. So in the beginning, when I first started, I was absolutely focusing on food and drink was more of my beat. But because I was in Bangkok, that automatically kind of gave it a travel angle and helped me do some travel stories. In the beginning, when I would do things like one of my early stories was about this technique that bartenders were doing in Thailand. That is something that I just like went and they showed me what was happening and there wasn't really a financial obligation there. Same thing for, I was trying to find out if people actually drank crocodile blood to cure cancer. So I'm going around on my own dime to a place where there are a bunch of crocodiles, to pharmacies, trying to find this thing out. No budget or anything. Once I got to the magazine that I worked for just 3 months, and I will always feel bad about that. That was a case of me burning a bridge. Bad move. Well, not a professional thing to leave that quick. But anyway, it was a luxury lifestyle magazine. And this is the first time I experienced press trips for me. And when I was in public relations, we coordinated them for journalists. They pay for you to go out and see their hotel property or pay for you to go to the restaurant, cover your restaurant experience, or they'll fly you out to a destination that they represent. And then you experience it and you go home and they hope that you write something nice about them. I had my first trip like that at the magazine that I was working at. I went to a beautiful resort in Thailand and was like, this is crazy. I am underqualified. I just started writing and I'm on a yacht. This is insane. And then when I became freelance, then I'm getting those invitations myself. So I did a lot of trips that were paid for that went to distilleries, going out into rural Mexico and seeing how mezcal is made at these tiny places or more established places that, you know, have a more industrial feel, going to do that in Scotland. And how I treated that was an amazing opportunity to have these things that I could absolutely never afford. I couldn't afford to travel to all these places, to go there for the purpose of, I need to write this story on this alcohol, but while I'm there, either stay a little longer or find time in between the stuff that you're supposed to do to find other stories. For example, in Scotland, went there for a whiskey brand. While I was there, found out about this local tradition of drinking this alcohol called Buckfast that has like a infamous reputation. That way I'm getting two different stories out of it. One is what the brand wants. Hopefully, I think the other thing for that, that gives press trips a bad name, is that you might go on this trip and be like, this alcohol is great. Everything's good. And for me, it was trying to find more genuine. A distiller had told me about how people used to write their lover's initials in agave plants. And I thought it was like the sweetest thing. So they ended up being like the expert voice in that story, but it wasn't like, go drink this mezcal. It was just, so I think for people who are getting into it, you can be more creative with how you say yes to these trips and what ends up coming out of it, and not just being like, I'm a shill for this brand. But
one of the things that I see a lot online, whether it is bloggers or influencers or just freelancers, people always say, how can they afford it?
Totally.
And you are right. There are times in which people come from backgrounds in which they can lavishly spend this money, but there are oftentimes other people who are just, you know, traveling on a budget. So it is possible if you just sit down and sort of crack the numbers. But how do you do it? And how do you recommend other people to do it for those people listening to us that are like, okay, what, traveling to 100 countries, you know, a year? How? How, Natalie? Yeah. So tell us.
Right. I would say whenever people come to me and ask me about doing what I've done or doing what I do, I always want to be as honest as possible and say, I do not have any money saved. This is not a good thing. I do not own a home. I do not have a lot of the things that a lot of people my age would be like, I want to have that. I sold my car when I moved to DC, not because I needed the money, but because I bike everywhere. And so I think a lot of people wouldn't be comfortable in the position that I'm in. But in my life, having had that accident in particular and thinking I almost was paralyzed and ruined the life that I thought I was going to have, I have always just wanted to seize the day and try to do as much as possible while I could. And it's maybe very naive to think I'll catch up later. Now that I'm at this job, I can start saving for retirement in the 401k that they have. But otherwise, I have spent almost every dollar on travel and beautiful foods and drinks around the world. And that has, those prices actually were worth something because all of those experiences got me this job. So I absolutely don't regret any of it. I just worry about the day that I'm 75 and like, oh no, I have no money and I'm living on a cruise ship. I don't know. So I would say that in the beginning, when I first started to travel, it was just, can I buy this ticket? Can I get a hostel there? What will I be able to do? Can I stay with somebody's family when I get there? When I moved to Thailand, leading up to it, I had been living in San Francisco, and instead of like trying to get lunch every day like people did in the office, I started buying a can of beans, and this truly so disgusting, and nobody ever do this. Thing of oatmeal was at the office for free, and so I would make like a savory oatmeal.
No,
and we lovingly called it oat bean at my office because then I could finally be honest about I'm going to be moving, and I was like, I'm trying to save as much money as possible. This is oat bean, and so that was like my $1 a day lunch. So saved as much as possible. Got to Thailand. That was obviously cheap. So I think choosing destinations where when you get there, the accommodations are going to be cheap. You right now, you can get a flight to Hawaii for $250. When you get there, it's going to be so expensive. And I think choosing travel destinations that are not always the top one. Paris is expensive. Switzerland is so expensive. London is insanely expensive. But you can go to other parts of the world where you can do amazing things, have wonderful adventures, and it's not as expensive. It's within your means. So choosing destinations where that is possible, being realistic about what you can and can't do. Maybe you can't go on the excursion to go see the beautiful island when you are in Thailand. Like, do what you can afford. Find ways that if you can find a job that allows you to travel, that can be something where then you extend your time and go have a little adventure somehow. Something that I didn't take advantage of before is if you're planning a trip, looking at flight options that give you layovers places, that's almost like a free trip to another place. So you can see, instead of, okay, 4-hour layover in Denver, oh, I can push it to 24 hours, go stay in a hostel and leave the airport and go see Denver for a day and have that fun experience of something different. I think it's saying no to the other stuff. It's not getting the latest phone or like a new TV or every subscription service or these other things that we love in life. I love restaurants. Like, I love that. But you had I'll be eating at a restaurant when I travel. So it's prioritizing travel in a way that you remember. Like right now, all I'm thinking about is like, oh, I have these trips I want to take next year. How am I going to make that happen responsibly?
What are some of those places that you've been that you're like, wow, how do people not know about this? Like, how is it that this is not more famous than it actually is?
I feel like this one is not a secret because so many people go there, but people go and stick on a particular tourist track or stay for one day and call it, is Bangkok. People will go pass through, see the temples, run out, but it has super fun nightlife, amazing food scene. Living there gave me the opportunity to see it for more than just like this little blip. I would say that Laos, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. Going to Vientiane was like, this is a place insanely beautiful, delicious food, wonderful people, incredible scenery, nature, just everything. It was wonderful, and I don't think enough people go. A lot of the Thai food that people really love actually comes from like northern Thailand and Laos, where people all used to once be together in a space that then got divided, and you can eat just amazing there. It's a wonderful place. I honestly think going to secondary cities or rural parts of places can be really fun. I've had some just very silly, very memorable adventures going to different parts of Japan when I like couldn't afford stuff. There was an example of wanting to go surfing in Japan. I was like learning how to surf, but I couldn't afford to go to Chiba, which is like the most famous, easiest to get to surf place outside of Tokyo. And instead I found this place that I thought had a wave very far. Like it was a train ride and then like two buses. And I got there and there's no surf spot. Like there's no surf shops. I see where I think people surf, but there's no surfing infrastructure. There's no surf shop. I finally had to like take buses back to another town to try to find a surf shop. They don't rent them. They only sell them. But of course, none of this information is online. And I get lost on the way back and I'm sitting on a curb and I'm literally lost. And somebody like pulls up and it's this like young Japanese guy who had lived in Australia and speaks perfect English. And he drives me to like where I needed to go. And I was like, this is amazing.
I love you. Thank you.
Yeah. I had gotten lost on that same trip. And ask the bus driver, I don't know how to get here. And he told me to wait. And he finished his route, stopped the car, told me to get in his truck, drove me to where I needed to go. So, I mean, those are both stories of risk as a woman alone, I guess. Yeah. But they just, the vibe felt right. And if I hadn't have gone to these places that were like much more quiet and weren't used to tourists, some of those beautiful moments would have happened. Mm-hmm. So I think not always just being like, oh, I just go to Tokyo, seeing other places that might be famous for something else. There are so many beautiful places in the world. I find myself talking about Tel Aviv a lot, and it's not a secret, but I think people don't think about it for like the absolutely gangbusters dancing, staying up until like all hours of the night, amazing food, surfing, beaches. And that has been a really special place in my memory that I would like to go back to.
I like how you mentioned traveling as a solo woman. And I think it's important to bring that into the conversation too, because that's one, how do you get past that fear? And two, what are some actionable steps/practical tips that you can give women who want to travel alone?
It's horrible that we even have to have this conversation, obviously. It really bums me out that it has to be this way. And I feel conflicted because bad things do happen. Bad things have happened to me, mm-hmm. and bad things happen to other women. So to just say, just go do it feels naive, I guess, sometimes. But I also do believe that. I am happy to take on that risk. Not everybody wants to take the risk, and that's very understandable. I've had things happen in places where I didn't think they were going to happen. Like I went out with a concierge from a hotel in Marrakesh, and I thought, this person works at the hotel that I'm at. And then of course, like, it didn't go well. And I should have trusted my gut earlier when I realized, like, oh, he thinks this is a date. I thought he was just showing me around. And then the next thing I know, I'm like running into the street screaming for help. And you are thinking, I did this. But at the end of the day, you have to think, no, they did this. There are bad people wherever you go. And whether you're traveling in Denver or Morocco, something mm-hmm. could happen. So you just have to be conscious of that wherever you go. I think trusting your gut is something. I didn't trust my gut that night, and I should have. I just kept thinking, don't make it a hassle. It could be fine. Or other times when I felt completely safe and it did go well. I think always having a phone that will have service, or the ability, maybe you can't call internationally or something, but as long as you can call a local number or something, or even have like just connectivity is important mm-hmm. traveling alone, because anything could happen. Having money on you in some way, letting other people know where you are. My mom has me on Find My Friends, and so does my best friend. And so if I'm traveling in a place, I'm feeling weird about a taxi or something, I'll be like, I'm in this taxi. I feel weird. If you don't hear from me, and so-and-so, something has happened.
Go find me in Morocco.
Get me. It is not okay. And I think just asking other people what the deal is when you get to a place. I was just in Angola, Africa, and I had read these things from other people that were like, women should not go out at night. Women can't be alone. And I was just like, oh man, is that true? When I was feeling really just like, I can't spend my last night here in the hotel room and I'll have only eaten hotel food. And so instead of just doing it and then having people be like, why on earth would you do it? I talked to people at the hotel and was just like, is this safe? Should I go take this taxi to this restaurant? And they're like, yeah. I was like, oh, okay, great. I had a great time. There are places where maybe you just shouldn't do that. I didn't say, okay, well, I'm going to go walk mm-hmm. through this area where people had reported having bad things, but finding ways that you can do something as safely as possible, getting that feedback that this is a risk that you could take, or this might not even be risky at all. I have found myself sometimes putting on a ring on my ring finger, even though I'm not married, because I will have people, you know, ask, and I'll try to make up a story and it seems so silly, but not telling people your exact plans. It could be totally fine and they don't mean anything by it, but mm-hmm. you're not supposed to tell people where you're going, that you're traveling alone. You could say, oh, I'm going to meet friends, even if the friends mm-hmm. aren't going to meet you. Just trying not to give anybody too much information.
For women who look up to you as a travel journalist and want to get started, knowing what you know now, if they were to start in 2022, 2023.
I know that when we are looking for freelancers, or you're going to say yes to an assignment or something, you're looking at people's social media. And if you are trying to do this, like, you just have to know that that's one of your websites. That's a way people are going to be looking at you and seeing what you're all about. So posting stuff that you think tells your story or shows your quote unquote brand, having a website that you can point to and be a professional and link to things there. A lot of people say they want to write and just don't. They don't try and they don't start. I was in the same position. I feel the same way now in wanting to write a book, and I've been talking about this for years and I just don't do it. And I'm like, they can't even reject it because I didn't even write it. So if you want to do this, just start writing. You have to start writing. Mm-hmm. And knowing that they are going to say no a lot. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to say no all the time. And you just have to keep trying. If you think that you're going to be good at this and you want to try to do this, keep being persistent. Send as many emails as you can. Someone isn't paying for you to go travel somewhere. Travel on your own. Write a blog post about whatever you wish you could have written for that publication, and and do that practice on your own. And you don't have to have a certain background to get into this. I think a lot of times, as I had thought, you think, oh, you can only be a journalist if you went to journalism school. You can only be in journalism if you did internships at newspapers or started at newspapers and were the copy aide and worked your way up to investigative reporting. And that's not the case.
What is something that you haven't done that you want to do in life?
I really want to go to Mongolia. A friend of mine that I met one time at a press dinner in Los Angeles 10,000 years ago moved there and is somebody that really inspires me. Her name is Brianna Wilson, and she posts snippets from being out there and just magical looking. And it feels so different and very far away. So I'd like to go to Mongolia.
What will you tell your future self if you had that chance?
Well, if my future self is struggling financially, I will say, you are having the best time and it was worth it. Thank you for and not saving all of your money and doing these wild adventures, because if I died today, I would say I left it all on the table and I've had a great time.
Beyond your work, how do you want others to remember you?
I hope they remember me as nice. Sounds so dumb, but I hope that people remember that I was like a goofy, nice person and that I hopefully was helpful to them in some way and inspired them to do something. I think that in what you do and what I do, you often meet people who are like, I wouldn't have thought to do that if I hadn't seen you do it, or you gave me the inspiration to go to Brazil or do these things, to run so much. And I love hearing that every time when people tell me, I went to this restaurant because you went there, you told me to go there. I'm like, yes. I love sharing things and making people's travel better, or I love knowing that you quit your job to take a job that was a better fit for you or something. So hopefully leaving knowing that I helped people have more adventures, that's how I would like to be remembered.
Here are my top takeaways from our conversation. Number one, when there's a will, there's a way. Everything will work out at the end if you decide to make it work. Number two, growth often comes from feeling uncomfortable. It's okay to be a student again, even later in life. That just means you're evolving. And number three, being able to afford travel, especially on a budget, is not as impossible as it may seem. If you're serious about it, crack the numbers and save. Thank you so much for listening. Gracias, mi gente. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. That's so helpful and exciting to us. If you learned something from this episode, share it with a friend. I'm sure they'll enjoy it as well. We drop new episodes every single Monday morning, but you can always find us on Instagram at @eladnpodcast. And before you leave, we want to hear your takeaways from today's guest. Share with us via Instagram stories, and don't forget to tag @eladnpodcast and Victoria Leandra for a regram. See you next week. Hasta la próxima, familia.